Islamic Republic of Iran's main foreign policy priorities. He hoped that through cooperation and collective efforts, countries in the Persian Gulf region can both bring prosperity to their peoples and also play an important role as an energy hub in the regional and international economy. The SNSC chief, however, added that dialogue and understanding should replace military approaches to the settlement of disputes. Later in the day, Sheikh Tahnoun was granted an audience by President Dr. Sayed Ebrahim Raisi, who also welcomed promotional warm and friendly ties with the UAE and made it clear relations between the two Muslim countries should not be affected by the interference of foreigners. We hope it is a good beginning, and in order to show sincerity, the UAE would withdraw its military forces from Yemen and the islands of the Red Sea, and also wake up to the danger of its suicidal relations with the occupiers of Palestine.
A Leak in Paradise, Part 4.
I came back to Switzerland to take the bull by the horns and show society what the Swiss bank secrecy really means.
Every trial against Elma resulted in media coverage on what Swiss banks wanted to keep hidden. The press conference held 2 days before in London brought the international press thronging to Zurich. During the hearing, the prosecutor increased the sentence. She now considered 8 months of prison without parole for Elma instead of 8 months suspended sentence, as she considered Elma's new delivery of data to Assange as a provocation to the court.
He said he made many mistakes. Because he was under pressure, they put him under pressure, in psychological pressure, kind of a mobbing, etc. Elmer never wanted to have money. And quite to the contrary, others, I mean, Kieber in Vaduz or Falciani in Geneva, other cases, they said, I want some millions and I go to the Secret Service. Elmer sent his data to the tax man. I mean, the tax authorities and the papers, the press.
The central issue of the trial is to decide whether the Swiss law on banking secrecy includes data from the Cayman Islands. Two theories abound.
Heidi, what happened yesterday when we left you?
Basically, we drove home and Rudy was having a little nap in the car because he was exhausted after the whole day. And I felt like I was hungry and wanted to have something to eat. And we had a friend with us and we were going into our car subterranean garage.
This arrest had nothing to do with the trial that had taken place the day before. This new judicial investigation was triggered by Elmer's recent handover of data to Julian Assange. Dear David, how is the world treating you and your family? There's not much going on here besides the usual questioning. My health is deteriorating slowly but surely. However, I don't wish to complain. I'll survive as usual. By the way, I won success at the Federal Supreme Court. The Prosecutor's Office of the State of Zurich now has to investigate the whole issue of harassment by the private detectives. This was a real setback for the Zurich Department of Justice, whose continued decisions to not open an investigation were considered arbitrary by the Supreme Judicial Authority of Switzerland. While Rudolf Elmer was in prison, Bank Julius Baer had some legal issues. The bank agreed to pay a 50 million euro fine to Germany to avoid prosecution for assistance in tax fraud. In the US, the bank was indicted on a conspiracy charge. A New York court accused it of having helped wealthy US taxpayers to hide over $600 million from the tax authorities in Switzerland.
This was the power of the state being used to support fundamentally an illicit, well, let's be blunt about it, an illegal activity, tax evading. The tax evasion is the basis of the Swiss economy. You know, that's what the Swiss banks work on. Since 1934, when Switzerland put their banking secrecy in place to deliberately help people from other countries evade tax. All the other stories about why they created their banking secrecy are rubbish. They did it to help people evade tax, and they still are.
It's not only a slap in the face of the prosecution office, it's also a slap in the face of the judge who found me guilty in January. And it's a slap in the face as well on the other prosecution office which was responsible for putting me in prison 19th January after the trial.
Rudolf Elmer dropped the harassment charges against the bank and its private detectives in exchange for a sum of around 600,000 Swiss francs. He then placed the money in a trust on the Isle of Man for his daughter in an offshore trust like those he criticizes. But his trust is declared to the Swiss tax authorities.
The Germans already bought another CD. It's an epidemic of stealing data and selling it. That's an epidemic. That's the wrong business model, actually. I sent it directly to the Swiss tax authorities. I didn't ask for money. Maybe I should have. Huh? No. No. Would be definitely wrong. No. I'm myself again, which I haven't been for many years. And I do think I helped the society up to a certain extent to make things known. It's also healthy to me, being able to get all the secret matters I was carrying around in my brain and trying to hide and not to talk about it out of my system.
Jan Sigler said, Switzerland is the world capital of dealing with stolen goods. Coffee farmers, of course, are very poor people, 26 million of them. And where do you think the coffee profits go to? Switzerland. Mispricing. UBS and Credit Suisse commodity trading. You want to study oil and gas? Switzerland. You want to study gold? Switzerland. You want to study diamonds? Switzerland.
I filed complaints to the prosecution office about Julius Baer, to the federal prosecution office. I filed complaints about journalists down there, to binders. For the Köppel case, and there are two binders related to the Bilanz Leo Müller case. Then up there is one which I took to the federal court. It's another one to the federal court. Considering all the complaints and the challenges I filed with the prosecution office, with the higher court, with the federal courts, so at least 60. I think it is important for me to express that I don't accept the system the way it works. And I do that in writing, and I do that in a way I'm allowed to do. And if I don't take any action, then I do accept the system the way it works.
The Swiss Justice Department continued to pursue Rudolf Elmer. On December the 10th, 2014, a new trial against him began in Zurich. This new case was triggered by his handing over of CDs to Julian Assange in London in 2011. Prosecutors also charged Elmer for sending bank data to WikiLeaks in 2008, a leak that Elmer had admitted to for years without triggering any legal proceedings. This new trial for breach of banking secrecy began even though the first trial, for almost the same reasons, was ongoing. But this time, Rudolf Elmer faced a heavy sentence, 3.5 years in prison.
The way that Swiss destroy people is not the way that French destroy people, or Americans destroy people, or Russians destroy people. In Russia, Rudolf Elmer would have been dead. The number one strength of Switzerland is psychological warfare. Rudolf Elmer is under psychological warfare operations since years.
The trial of Rudolf Elmer resumed 1 month later, despite advice from his physicians. Elmer received a suspended fine of 45,000 Swiss francs for breach of banking secrecy. He was convicted only for having sent confidential data to WikiLeaks in 2008. Not for the handing over of CDs to Julian Assange in London in 2011, even though this was the reason he spent 6 months behind bars. He appealed the decision. After 10 years of struggle, Rudolf Elmer was exhausted. He had to be hospitalized in a specialist clinic. Has his fight against banking secrecy and the Swiss justice and media been worth the cost? And for what results? The system that he fights, dodges, shifts, and renews itself. After a 3-month rest, Rudolf Elmer is back for a new challenge. His candidate in local elections for the Alternative List, the most left-wing party on the political spectrum. This is the only party to have supported Elmer since his return to Switzerland in 2010.
Could be the beginning of a political career. There are more elections to come soon. And therefore, yeah, maybe there's a surprise. Let's see. I'm positive about the thing. I enjoy it, actually, because I do think I do. If I return to Switzerland and to get involved in this political field is important, because it's the same thing as with my case, taking the bull by the horns. And if you want to change something, then you have to put your sleeve back and go for it. And that sort of thing I'm doing.
Today we are on a level where it's out of proportion. In simple terms, the taxes which are not paid by those multinationals, financial institutions, and high net worth individuals need to be paid by the man in the street. And the man in the street is so much under pressure that he might stand up. And violence is very close, very, very close. So it's better to solve the system now than going through that process.
Since all of this debate of offshore tax havens and automatic exchange of information got started, assets in Switzerland have only increased every month. Why? Because in the real world, people know that if they are attacking Vanuatu and Jersey and all the other little tax havens, the money from those tax havens moves to Switzerland. Last year, the Swiss Bankers Association officially reported 320 billion increase in assets under management. 320 billion of 5.5 trillion Swiss francs. An increase of 6% is a lot. It's a lot.
and Mizumura are refugees in their own country, on land that is gradually eroded by the temperamental Brahmaputra River. 160,000 people live on Majuri, who might sooner or later become refugees. The government is quite worried about that.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
In the limelight.
Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds are structurally oppressed by the Israeli apartheid regime and subjugated to its systematic detention, arrest, dispossession, land theft, and killings. For decades, Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds have been victims of ongoing ethnic cleansing. We're prepared for you an article written by Denijol Jejic, an author and researcher from Lebanon, under the heading, The Apartheid Regime's Extrajudicial Executions of Palestinians. Mohammad Shokat Salima, a 25-year-old Palestinian, was shot at point-blank range and martyred by Israeli occupation forces in occupied eastern Al-Quds. Zionist authorities and much of Western media framed him as an attacker. However, the extrajudicial killings of Palestinians on occupied land are part and parcel of the settler colonial regime's terror against the indigenous population. A video of Mohammad Shokat Salima's assassination by Israeli occupation forces was filmed by bystanders and went viral on the internet. It shows that the young Palestinian did not pose any imminent threat to the heavily armed Israeli occupation forces. He was shot repeatedly and martyred as he lay wounded on the ground. According to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, Israeli occupation forces denied medics access to the site, and thus, Mohammad Shokat Salima could not receive any first aid. Israeli occupation authorities justified the murder, claiming that the assassinated Palestinian had previously tried to stab an Israeli. extrajudicial assassinations of Palestinians, including innocent children by the Israeli regime, are not isolated incidents, but part and parcel of the genocidal settler colonial terror. While the Israeli regime claims to be a democracy, Palestinians are not only subject to brutal military rule, but also excluded from the entity's so-called legal system. Palestinians are dehumanized to an extent that they can be killed in cold blood at any time. The justification for the assassination of Palestinians is always present in the Zionist narrative, as is the jailing and kidnapping of Palestinians by the apartheid regime. As part of the broader coercion strategy in the aftermath of the assassination, Israeli occupation forces terrorized residents in Salima's hometown of Salfit in the occupied West Bank, raided the home of Salima and arrested his brother. While the story seemed newsworthy, much of the mainstream Western media failed to identify the power relations, the colonial nature, and the particular illegality of Israel's actions under international law. Indeed, in much of the mainstream media, the assassination was portrayed as a reaction to the stabbing attempt and within a context of the broader violence in eastern Al-Quds. News agencies provided headlines such as "Israeli wounded in eastern Al-Quds stabbing, assailant killed," or "Police kill Palestinian attacker after Al-Quds stabbing," oftentimes categorizing the story under so-called Israel-Palestine conflict within Zionist terms. In an article by Al Jazeera English, based on reports from news agencies, the Palestinian victim is portrayed as an attacker stabbing Jewish man. The article states that Israeli security forces shot the Palestinian after he stabbed an Israeli civilian and tried to attack the police. The first source to be mentioned is Israel's Magen David Adom emergency service. Similarly, the New York Times opposed the Palestinian assailant to the Israeli civilian. This framing and the focus on religion and ethnicity makes it seem as if a dangerous Palestinian decided to kill an innocent Jewish civilian and thus had to be stopped by police officers. The incident is thus portrayed as a violent hate crime perpetrated by the Palestinian man. Yet, much of the discourse obscures the colonial context and the asymmetrical power relations. The Palestinians' actions are not the source of violence in occupied Palestine. In fact, he's a victim of the apartheid and occupying regime and has probably suffered his entire life under a brutal military occupation and the multifaceted abuses that come with it. Not only can the Zionist military forces kill Palestinians at any time, they also enjoy impunity and the apartheid regime's backing. Indeed, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was quick to express his support for the execution of the Palestinian and in appreciation posted a picture of the killers on social media. The Zionist leader said, "That is how our forces are expected to act and that is how they acted." Support for the assassination was echoed throughout the Zionist political spectrum. Referring to Israelis on illegally occupied lands as civilians further normalizes Israeli colonial violence. Most Israelis, regardless whether they are actively enlisted in the occupying army or not, have undergone military training and enjoy backing of the apartheid regime. For example, settler violence is a well-documented ongoing form of terrorism that is directly backed by the colonial regime apparatus. And of course, the mere presence of Israeli military forces in eastern Al-Quds is illegal in itself, given that the territory is under military occupation. Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds, where the assassination of Mohammad Shoukat Salima took place, are structurally oppressed by the Israeli apartheid regime and subjugated to its systematic detention, arrest, dispossession, land theft, and killings. For decades, Palestinians in eastern Al-Quds have been victims of ongoing ethnic cleansing. The Israeli apartheid regime has created a judicial system that allows them to steal Palestinian lands and property and dispossess them in order to make place for Jewish settlers. Any media narrative that fails to identify the colonial context in the occupied Palestine further justifies the Zionist violence. In this settler colonial conquest of a nuclear-armed First World power against an indigenous people under military occupation, Palestinians have long been criminalized for merely surviving on their own land, and thus standing in the way of the Israeli colonizer. While their structural daily struggle is not newsworthy, their individual reactions to the Zionist terror becomes highly scrutinized in the mainstream Western media. Palestinians have the right to use all means at their disposal to resist against a foreign occupation, including armed struggle. This is even acknowledged by the United Nations, which enshrines this right in Resolution 37 and Resolution 43 from December of 1982. The brutal assassination of Mohammad Shoukat Salima became newsworthy because it was captured on camera and because the assassinated Palestinian allegedly tried to stab an Israeli. Meanwhile, Palestinians get shot and murdered by the Israeli military forces continuously off camera. A day before Mohammad Shoukat Salima was assassinated, a Palestinian was martyred by Israeli military forces in Umm al-Fahm in the occupied West Bank. A day later, a 15-year-old Palestinian teenager, Mohammad Nidal Yunus, was murdered by Israeli forces at a checkpoint near Tul Karm in the occupied West Bank. However, the Israeli attackers and assailants are not referred to as such in the dominant media discourse. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, in the occupied Palestinian territories has expressed its shock after Israeli military forces assassinated Mohammad Shoukat Salima in cold blood in eastern Al-Quds, in the old city of Al-Quds. The Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, in a statement on Sunday, 5th of December, promised to follow up on the incident and demanded that those responsible for such brutality must be brought to justice. The statement read, "Extrajudicial killings such as this are the consequence of the regular resort to lethal force by well-armed and well-protected Israeli personnel against Palestinians, and the almost total lack of accountability for killings and injuries of Palestinians by Israeli forces." The statement added, "Will there be accountability in this case?" Local sources and the Red Crescent Society said the Israeli police prevented medical personnel from providing medical care for the 23-year-old Palestinian youth. Israeli forces also attacked Palestinians nearby and fired tear gas canisters at them after shooting the young Palestinian. At least 40 people were injured by the Israeli forces at the scene. They also closed all gates of the Holy Al-Aqsa Mosque for worshippers who were heading to the Holy Mosque to perform the evening prayers. The Israeli military attacked a group of women who were heading towards the Al-Aqsa Mosque and prevented them from entering. They also launched a massive arrest campaign targeting Palestinians. The Tel Aviv regime has been criticized for its extensive use of lethal force against the extrajudicial killing of Palestinians who do not pose an immediate threat to Israeli forces or Israeli settlers. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry has on several occasions called on the International Criminal Court at The Hague, Netherlands, to break its silence and immediately begin investigations into the crimes of the occupying regime and Israeli settlers. The United Nations Human Rights Council, in a recent annual report, voiced its deep concern at the fragmentation of the occupied Palestinian territories, including Eastern Al-Quds, through illegal settlement activities and other measures. It also said it was gravely concerned that the long-standing impunity for international law violations has allowed for the recurrence of grave violations without consequence.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing Embargo, directed by Jerry Rice. And joining me in the studio, we have Tim Roby, who is a film critic for the Daily Telegraph and who's also a regular guest on BBC Film 2017 and Radio 4's film programme. And beside him, we are also joined by Cuba expert Dr. Helen Yaffe, who is a lecturer at the University of Glasgow and has also written a book about Che Guevara's economic policies. Now, Embargo chronicles the story of the politics and collusion behind the Cuban embargo, its history, impact, and evolution, along with information from recently declassified documents and high-profile interviews. This film gives a unique perspective dating back before the 1959 Cuban Revolution that put Fidel Castro to power and led to the failed CIA-backed Bay of Pigs invasion and 1962's Cuban Missile Crisis. The film's compelling truths ultimately link the threads of an untold history and become the film's core message to end the embargo and looks to a future of rebuilding diplomatic and economic relations.
My father spent most of the 13 days in the White House, and he said that we had to be good soldiers and show up at school, that if there was a nuclear war, that none of us would want to be around our kids.
Each small mistake will bring us to the confrontation. My father repeated, if we lose control, we will not be in charge.
Dad virtually told me nothing about Cuba. When Castro came in to overthrow Batista, my father must have been pretty thrilled, actually. You know, because he could remember Batista was not such a great guy.
We've been lied to since 1959 about Cuba, and we're still being lied to today. This unholy alliance between Nixon, the mafia, and the CIA still impacting us today.
At no time has the CIA engaged in any political activity that was not approved at the highest level.
We made it United States policy to assassinate Fidel Castro.
Wow, this is not what we bargained for. We just thought we were going to get rid of a corrupt government.
The president held out an olive leaf to Castro, and he said to him, the United States history in Cuba has been a history of atrocities, and we understand that we're going to have to pay for that in one way or another.
Now, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this is a film that takes a critical look at the U.S.'s trade ban on Cuba and the political turmoil between the two countries. And it also features lots of generous footage of archive footage and high-profile interviews with historical figures and celebrities alike. And Tim, if I could start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, the subject is fascinating and has been thorny and, you know, much contested for, 60 years now. My feeling is that the subject deserves a more incisive treatment than this film, and one which is more analytical and more focused on what it's trying to achieve.
For me, it feels like a kind of fairly skimpy overview. It's like a kind of whistle-stop tour of Cuba's sort of greatest hits historically since the 50s, which sort of lets you sort of land on the big moments, but doesn't really explain them. I mean, there are little nuggets of interest along the way, and some of the interviews do reveal things, but I felt that in general there was quite a lack of kind of intelligence around the film.
It surely is a huge subject with lots of layers, and perhaps for audiences who are not familiar with this issue, it serves as a good introduction to the subject. Helen, if I could turn to you, as someone who's spent many years in Cuba and studied Cuba, what was your take on this documentary?
I think precisely for the reasons that you're saying, it's a good, engaging documentary. It has that historical overview, which I guess that, you know, when you've studied Cuba, you know that history, you sort of take it for granted that others do. But it provides that. There's some great archival image. There's really good interviews. My only issue with it is that because it was called Embargo, I was hoping to see more focus on the embargo and, you know, the series of laws that were introduced at different points by different presidents in the United States and the impact that they've had on the Cuban people and on the rest of the world because of the extraterritorial nature of the embargo. But as a sort of general introduction, it didn't offer anything particularly new or novel, but it was, you know, some nice material and a good reminder of, you know, that relationship between the United States and Cuba. I do think that there were areas where more analysis would have been useful. Why was the United States so hostile against the Cuban Revolution? What was it that they were doing that was so unacceptable to the US power structure? So more on...
That's precisely the questions, actually, I'd like to ask you a bit later on.
The major premise of the American blockade of Cuba is to starve the Cuban people into submission or rebellion. It is a violation of all moral and legal standards to use the starvation of people as a foreign policy tool.
Well, the embargo was originally intended to wreak havoc in Cuba and create instability. There's no two ways around that. In 1965, Johnson then added food, for now part of the official embargo, and then medicine was also added as well.
I would say to all my fellow Americans, let us continue.
If a financial transaction takes place with American dollars abroad and an American bank is involved, that transaction is illegal. If a ship docks in Cuba to let off supplies that have been purchased legally by Cuba, that ship may not then proceed to an American port. It is a blockade that is unilateral only because no one else in the world wants to join the United States in this insane policy, but it is so extraterritorial in nature that it involves other countries whether they like it or not.
So Tim, the documentary argues that the embargo fails both the US and Cuba. What were the reasons laid out in the film for this?
Well, it's a little vague. This section of the film is the bit that deals with the embargo probably most fully. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be fleshed out a lot more. It dates back to a whole history of kind of government antipathy between Fidel Castro and a succession of American presidents. And we see them sort of ticked off one by one, if you like, mm-hmm. and the relationship just deteriorates. I mean, it's pretty bad with Kennedy, and it just gets worse and worse. By George W. Bush, it's really shocking. I really thought that the film could have focused on that entirely, and that would have been a very valid approach. Instead, we get a lot of other bits and bobs of kind of other sort of facets of Cuban kind of politics and history. Anyone who hasn't visited Cuba might struggle to kind of get the hang of the politics there and to get the hang of what a complicated country it is and the complicated relationship between the people of Cuba and Castro in his day, and also between Cuban Americans and Castro, who had quite a hostile relationship to him. The film does bring all of that up, and I was, you know, in some ways grateful to be reminded of some of those things. So yeah, I mean, it was interesting to delve back into all of this subject. I've been to Cuba myself, and It reminded me of a lot that I learned when I was there.
A good point that you raise, actually. There is a lot of propaganda against Cuba, so this film perhaps serves as a good counter-narrative to that propaganda.
It does, up to a point. I sort of felt that sometimes it was being a bit sketchy about the specifics. I think there's some statistic that among imported goods into Cuba, still quite a lot comes from the USA, something between 6 and 7%, something like that. And you would think from this film that it was an absolute 0% blockade. So that kind of detail gets a little bit elided, I think, in the narrative.
And Helen, if I could turn to you now to shed more light on the embargo itself. Mm. It seems like from the documentary that the US was the only country in the world that had a problem with Cuba. And why were the reasons for this, and were they justified?
So after the revolution, it wasn't declared as socialist straight away. There was a period where there was tit-for-tat retaliations between the United States government and the Cuban government. So the process of nationalizations didn't take place until almost 2 years after the triumph of the revolution. And at the point where the Cuban government started to nationalize, they offered the foreign companies compensation based on the value that they had claimed their businesses were worth for tax purposes. And Canadian companies, French companies, they took the compensation. So that settled the claim. But in the United States, the Eisenhower government had told US companies not to accept compensation. Why? Because they were already planning the Bay of Pigs invasion, which obviously is inconceivable to them that it wouldn't work and they wouldn't be able to throw out the nascent revolutionary government. So that was, the opportunity there was to resolve those issues. And subsequently, the US blockade or embargo, depending on who's speaking, has been, it's the pretext has been it's a punishment for these nationalizations, but the reality has been it's always been at the center of a larger program which is trying to achieve regime change in Cuba.
And Tim, how damaging was the embargo? The film touches on this quite a bit. To Cuban society, and what effect did it have as laid out in the documentary?
Well, yeah, it creates a kind of big divide in Cuba. I don't feel the doc really does enough of that, actually. And there are a lot of comparisons, interesting comparisons that could be made between kind of the American the welfare state and the Cuban welfare state, for instance, which the film just doesn't bother with. There are pros and cons of Cuban culture and life that I feel are left out. But I think perhaps what it would have been much better as is a much more focused one on just the embargo.
And Helen, the embargo itself, instead of Cuba falling down to it, actually, were they able to survive and not only that, thrive?
They were able to survive, and let's be clear, in the initial period, that was thanks to the help from the Soviet Union. As you said, I focused my work on Che Guevara's economics, and he had a dream. He was in charge of industrialization, of taking the most advanced technology in the world and implementing that in Cuba. But of course that was cut off, because immediately the US government was contacting the Prime Minister of Britain and saying you cannot sell equipment or transport or anything to Cuba. So they had a very extensive trade. By the time that the Soviet bloc collapsed, 85% of Cuba's trade took place with that part of the world. And so, in a sense, that trade had protected Cuba from the US blockade, from the impact of the embargo, because it didn't affect that trade. It could still carry out. The Soviet Union, Eastern Germany, and so on weren't going to pay any attention. But the double whammy of the blockade was felt then in the 1990s after the collapse of the Soviet bloc. And that's when Cuba entered something called a special period in time of peace. And that was my first experience of living in Cuba was in the 1990s. And, it was extraordinarily hard. Even if you had dollars, there was the pharmacies were empty, food shops were empty, equipment just lay abandoned because they couldn't get the spare parts.
So the embargo was affecting the lives of everyday Cubans.
We made it, United States policy, to assassinate Fidel Castro. This was our policy, to bring down the Cuban government.
By the summer of 1959, the CIA is working with some mobsters to try and kill Fidel Castro. Nixon just ordered the CIA to ratchet up their plots with the mafia. pretty audacious plan that's now been very well documented, but only in the last 2 or 3 years when the National Archives found some files that really helped to lay some of this stuff out for the first time.
Dr. Castro, an American magazine published a story this week which says that Dr. Castro really hates America.
When am I going to hate to the people of the United States? I don't hate anybody.
Someone who's not familiar with the subject, some of these revelations in the documentary might seem like a bombshell, really. And you would think some of these things were conspiracy theories, these plots to take down Castro. Tim, were you surprised by this and by some of the findings and evidence of the documentary?
I wasn't really surprised because I've seen some of the films about Castro, for instance, and Oliver Stone made a film about him, and I've read books on the subject. This film does come down rightly very hard on the CIA and kind of presents it as sort of a banker-funded mafia with its own interests, stock market at heart. And you see that the kind of successive attempts of the CIA to kind of unsettle the Castro regime and unseat him. And it goes as far as assassination attempts. But again, I would love to have seen much more specific evidence of that. You could really go into the details on that and kind of deal with it. We get a little bit of documentation, but really not very much. I feel as though it's the makings of a really compelling kind of conspiracy-themed doc on that subject, which is very different from the doc about the embargo that we're sometimes getting as well. So they kind of sit side by side a little bit uneasily. I did find that section of the film kind of picked up the pace a little bit. I'll give it that.
It was incredibly exciting and fascinating, actually, this part of the documentary. And Helen, if I could turn to you, just going back about the assassination attempts on Castro. I mean, according to another documentary, 638 Ways
which
to
I was
Kill
gonna mention,
Castro, Fabian Escalante claims that there have been over 600 times attempts on Castro's life over a span of 40 years.
Yeah.
Why were there so many attempts, and then why did they fail?
I think two things are important. One is that the US government has never understood what a revolution means in the sense that they have such a sort of personalized politics. They felt like taking out Fidel would destroy what was a mass movement, a revolution. And secondly, because of what he represented, and that's another element I think is missing, the fact that Cuba was able to implement free universal healthcare, education, access to culture and so on. And what does that say in exposing the US model where they say, you have to pay for healthcare and if you don't, you're left to die in the street. So, really the biggest threat that Cuba presented was not the Soviet missiles that were there in 1962, but the biggest threat was the sort of threat of an alternative form of development. And that's what, the US was so afraid of contaminating the rest of Latin America.
And Tim, if I could turn to you, would you have any thoughts to add to what Helen just said involving with the film?
On the subject of this spreading to Latin America, domino theory stuff, I guess, that's an interesting one as well. And the degree to which Cuba could be a kind of like a ringleader in that sense. There are films about that as well, and there are films about the Cuban Missile Crisis specifically.
Yeah.
There's 13 days, as mentioned, the 13 days in which it happened.
Perhaps what's unique about this documentary, then, as by first-time filmmaker Jerry Rice, is that she was so taken by this subject, and she involves herself in the journey. So from the perspective of sort of a layman's point of view, this takes you on that journey also.
It does. She starts off as quite a presence in the film, and you kind of get have the sense of her kind of journeying there and this conversation that she had with Castro on a bus. And then she sort of drops out of it, and it sort of tries to become a bit more of an overview. And she kind of comes back in a little bit at the end. But I don't want to be overly negative because there are things of value here, but I feel as though the film is indecisive about whether it's a personal treatise on Cuba and on the embargo, or if it's more of a kind of impersonal overview of the subject. I think it never quite makes its mind up, and you can kind of sense the vagueness in it, because sometimes the film will transition from one subject area into another with a little bit of music thrown in just to kind of help us over the bumps. I felt as though there needed to be much more of a sense of structure. Perhaps she started the film too early and hasn't got enough material from the last couple of years. There have been a lot of changes, as we'll talk about, and perhaps what it's missing is that most recent stuff that would really have helped kind of build the argument a bit more forcefully, I think.
I think even in terms of the embargo, I mean, people are talking about it in the past tense, especially since Obama announced rapprochement with Cuba.
President Trump will treat the Castro regime as a malevolent dictatorship that it is. Thank you, President Trump. You have not betrayed us. You kept your promise.
I am so thrilled to be back here with all of my friends in Little Havana.
And you mark my words. And you mark my words. Whether it's in 6 months or 6 years, Cuba will be free.
We just didn't fight hard enough. Now, those days are over. Now we hold the cards. We now hold the cards. We will enforce the ban on tourism. We will enforce the embargo.
And Helen, as I noticed, you're shaking your head at Marco Rubio. Why was that?
Marco Rubio has some leverage over Trump, and he seems to be playing the tune that Trump is dancing to at present. It's worth pointing, as a businessman, Trump sent his representatives to talk to the Cuban government about business opportunities in 1998, when it still was illegal before rapprochement, and also in the early 2000s. So Trump, with his businessman hat on, had, you know, said, I have no problem with lifting the embargo. And in fact, he said that at the beginning of his electoral campaign. But obviously, when he became a serious candidate, he had to do the done thing and go to Miami and win the support of the Rubios and the other Cuban-American politicians. And he obviously, you know, made deals with them.
Of course, Florida was a turning point in the election for Trump winning. Tim, if I could turn to you, how was Trump portrayed in this documentary, and is he shown as responsible for reigniting the hostility between the US and Cuba?
He is shown as doing that in that clip, which is pretty much the last 2 minutes of the film. That is it, what we've just seen. That's the only time we see Trump. What strikes me about that clip is that it's cut like a trailer. It was incredibly fast, and the footage was just flowing in. The music's really hammering this out. You could watch a 90-minute film just on that. And instead, we end with this kind of rapid-fire trailer montage of the harm that Trump has done. It really is all too hasty, I think. I wanted commentary on that. I wanted people talking about that. I wanted analysis of that. Instead, we just see his speech. We see it happening. And then we kind of go home and hope that things change.
But there's only so much time, I suppose, you can cram into a documentary.
Of course, yeah. But I just feel as though it's biting off more than it can chew, fundamentally. And I think if it had just focused a bit more, I think we would have a more valuable film.
I mean, you know, like, under the Obama administration, there were more fines against third countries and companies in third countries.
But, of course, it wasn't Obama trying to ease relations with Havana.
He did too little too late. The U.S. embargo blockade is codified in U.S. law. It can only be lifted by a vote in Congress. But as the president, he could issue executive decrees. And those he did issue on very limited basis to allow, you know, 6 airlines to fly from the United States to Cuba and a couple of hotels. But he could have gone far further, and he didn't. And in fact, you know, under Obama, some of the fines were astonishingly high. So the French bank Paribas was fined nearly $9 billion for, you know, interactions with financial interactions, not just with Cuba, also with Sudan and Iran. And then, you know, the fines are just endless. If you read the Cuban motion to the United Nations General Assembly when they have the annual vote, it will list some of the fines, and they go up right to the end of the Obama administration. So it was a very sort of two-sided coin.
Relations.
Exactly.
I'm afraid I'd love to talk more on this topic, but we've run out of time on the show. Thanks very much for coming on. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambiati.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Former U.S. Senator David Perdue, encouraged by Donald Trump, is challenging Governor Brian Kemp, a fellow Republican who defied the former president. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Richard Fawcett and Jonathan Martin. The piece is titled Right versus Right versus Left. Governor's race puts Georgia at center of 2022 drama. Former U.S. Senator David Perdue's leap on Monday, 6th of December, into a primary challenge against Governor Brian Kemp, his fellow Republican, ensured that Georgia will be at the hot molten core of the political universe next year, with costly and competitive races that will test the grip of Trumpism over the Republican Party and measure the backlash against President Joe Biden in a state that increasingly reflects the country's demography and its divisions. Already a battleground at the presidential level, Georgia will be the scene of intense Republican primary showdowns for both governor and secretary of state, followed by general election contests in which Democrats, led by Senator Raphael Warnock, who is seeking a full term, and Stacey Abrams, who narrowly lost the 2018 governor's race to Mr. Kemp and announced another bid last week, hope to keep the state a bluer tint of purple. David Perdue, who lost his Senate seat after one term to the Democrat John Ossoff in January, is former President Donald J. Trump's preferred candidate, while Mr. Kemp earned a place on Donald Trump's enemies list after declining to help the former president overturn his 2020 election loss in Georgia. The two will now face off in May of next year in an internecine war that may offer the closest approximation to a referendum on Trumpism next year as any in the country. "Look, I like Brian. This isn't personal," David Perdue said on Monday in a video announcing his candidacy, but he implied that Brian Kemp had damaged his standing with Georgia's Trumpist base of Republican voters. "He has failed all of us," David Perdue said of Brian Kemp, "and cannot win in November." Aides to Mr. Kemp gave Mr. Perdue a blistering reception,